Okay, hello everyone. This is not an announcement from the LOC this time. This is actually a presentation about a new method of studying type of bright supernovae with high cadence photometry. So this is work I've done with Panos Boumis. Actually, the slide is cut off. I don't know if that can be fixed. Sure, yes, I'll keep talking. It's work I've done with Panos Boumis at the National Observatory of Athens, and it was triggered by supernova 2014J, which went off in January 2014, and it's illustrated on that first page, a really nice image from the Hubble Space Telescope. The inset shows the supernova as it went off, well, after it exploded in January 2014. Now, why should we obtain high-cadence photometry? Well, there are various reasons. First of all, high-cadence photometry and the intraday behavior of light curves of supernovae is really uncharted territory. Typically, surveys studying supernovae obtain photometry once a night or a few times a night. So the timescales of hours or minutes are really not probed. So we would really like to explore this short timescale and low amplitude variability properties of their light curves. Now, why would we do that? The ultimate goals would be to learn about the physics of the supernova, for example, the explosions, if they're asymmetric, the ejecta, if there's clumpiness in the ejecta. And this image shows one of the really nice supernova remnants that we have images for in the LMC, although that's much later on in its lifetime. And to see if there can be a connection with that, that would be great. And ultimately, we want to learn also about the progenitor system of the supernova. Now let's go back to 2014J. As you probably all know, this was a really bright supernova that went off in M82 at 3.3 megaparsecs. It's a type 1A that reached 10.6 magnitudes in the V-band. Everyone was observing it. And we were wondering, what could we do with the Aristarchos telescope, so the 2.3 meter we have at the National Observatory of Athens, that actually during winter time is not scheduled because the weather, there's snow, and we don't have access to it all the time. So we had the idea of getting high-cadence photometry. We figured, who else has this telescope and all this time that they can sit on it for several nights to do this? I also found this alert from AAVSO alert from Bradley Schaefer, urging the amateur astronomers to observe this supernova since it was so bright and get high cadence photometry. So the quote is that fast variability is not expected from supernovae because the shell is too large to change fast, but then no one has ever looked. And then he goes on to compare it with Novi and USCO, where again in Novi such variability was not expected either, but flares were discovered and they still have not been explained. Now, this is an image from the telescope. So the weather finally opened up in mid-February, and we were able to go with Panos for four, and got four really good nights, February 16th through 19th. This was corresponding to day, it's around day 20th after maximum of the supernova. So we got series of V-band and B-band exposures, so 5 seconds and 20 seconds. And with the readout of the CCD, it came up to about 2 minute cadence. So we had 400, 500 points per night. We were able to observe it for 8 hours each night. The image here shows the supernova, smack in the middle. This is the V-band 5 second exposure. And we have the 5 comparison stars in the field. We just did aperture photometry, differential light curves, with basically using star one, but we computed all of them. So star one is the brightest star and the most useful for getting this differential light curve. Now here are the results. On the right hand, you have the light curves in each night. So we start with night one, night two, three, and four. We have the V-band in green and the blue, the B-band filter in blue. They're offset just for clarity. So it's the supernova minus star one, differential light curve with respect to Julian date. And you have the, you can see the slope, the supernova declining, fading in magnitude, and the decline slope changes in time, actually, as you can see from one night to the other. And most interestingly, we have evidence, we have these little wiggles and this evidence for rapid variability, which we were quite excited to see. But of course, we wanted to make sure this was real and quantified, and do we believe it or not? We went through a lot of this. Because, of course, high precision photometry is harder. Well, exoplanet people do it all the time. For us, it was new, so we're learning. But it seems that we have this 0.02, 0.02, 0.05 magnitude variations. Now, we're not claiming that all of them are real, because there are systematics, and I'm going to explain the analysis in the next slide. So here, I also wanted to point out that these nights correspond to this part of the light curve. So this is a nice light curve from Sivert et al. Using KELT, kilo-degree, extremely little telescope, so a 4-centimeter telescope, looking for exoplanet transits around bright stars, and they happened to observe M82 in their field, and they got this beautiful light curve. And they actually had several points per night. So this is the window we observed in, and it's right before the secondary maximum that occurs in type 1a supernovae. This happens when the opacity, as the supernova is expanding, the opacity drops as the iron group elements go from doubly to singly ionized state. So this was published earlier this year. Here's another table from our paper. This just shows the decline rates that we measured. So it was kind of cool to be able to measure the decline rate in each night. So we have the values for each night, each filter, and each differential light curve. Let's focus here to the values. So we have about 0.15 magnitudes per day, the rate for the first night, 0.09, 0.07, 0.04. This is for the V-band. While in the B-band, it's steeper, but again, it's getting shallower due to the secondary maximum that's taking place. Now, about the errors, the last three columns here give the error estimation. So we adopted the method by Pont et al., used in the exoplanet community, actually, because there are definitely systematics in the data. So we use this to estimate the red noise and the white noise and get an estimate of the errors of our measurement, which comes out to 3 to 6 millimag, depending on the night and the filter. Now, this variability corresponds to a fractional change in radius of 1 to 2.5%. On day 17 of the supernova, when we observed it, it was about 104 AU, so this would mean about one or a bit more than that AU difference. Now, of course, this doesn't mean the supernova is changing size. It's just the projected area that's fluctuating. It gives us some clue about that area. Sivert et al. From the KELT survey also had a limit on the variability, which was 4.5%. So we're consistent with that. We're being cautious. We're saying it's evidence for variability. But let's just point that out. Okay, so here are the light curves from night 3 and 4 that show the maximum variability. Starting from top to bottom, we have the differential light curves, supernova minus star 1, minus star 2, etc. We also had a trend fitting analysis based on the other comparison stars to see if the trends are visible. And the last panel shows star 1 minus star 2. That should be flat, and it's not completely, so that means that shows that there are systematics. But we think that in these regions where the vertical lines are, there is some variability that's statistically significant, at least if we take our error bars at face value. This 0.05 happened right here, magnitudes difference, and it appears in the rest of the light curves as well. And it, given our error bars, it's an 8 sigma detection in B-band and 10 sigma in B. And now what's also interesting is that the B-band, I didn't explain that, that's the blue curve with the red dots being the bin data, so the B-band precedes the V-band by about 10 minutes. So I'm not sure what that's due to, but that also is visible here on night 4 as well. So it's interesting that we have this variability on all 4 nights, so 4 consecutive nights, and all show these little wiggles. Night 3 and night 4 show more wiggles, and we have this behavior of the B-band preceding the V-band. Now, what's the origin of this variability? Now, from what we could find from the literature, no one has really made predictions of what light curves look like for supernovae in these timescales. What we found was some scenarios, perhaps more than one, are taking place. It could be due to some clumping of the ejecta, possibly caused by structures of intermediate mass elements in the outer layers, as suggested by Hole et al. We could have interaction of the ejecta with a circumstellar medium. There's evidence for this by Foley et al. From the spectra that they took. It could be perhaps a symmetry of the ejecta, non-spherically symmetric explosion, or the onset of the secondary maximum that I described, or a combination of some of the above. Now, while our work was under review, actually, two really nice papers came out, also on high cadence variabilities from Kepler. So Kepler, in the K2 mission, has been staring at some fields for, I think, I don't remember if it was exoplanets, probably for exoplanets, and they happened to find supernovae serendipitously in their fields, and they got these beautiful light curves. They're staring at the field for 60 days, and they have these amazing light curves of these supernovae. So Olin et al. Had presented three type 1As, and they were looking for signature of ejecta interaction, and they didn't find any. And Garnovich et al. A few months ago published these light curves of these type 2 supernovae, and actually for the first time detected shock breakout in the optical in one of them. So these are really nice results. I should mention though that Kepler K2 has a cadence of 30 minutes. So perhaps the variability on the time scale of 15 to 60 minutes that we found, perhaps they were not sensitive to it. But this field is in its infancy, I think, so it's very exciting to see what will come out. Oh. Now, how many bright supernovae are there? So I just show a list here. This column is the maximum magnitude, and these are just supernovae over the last 3 years mainly that are reached magnitude above 15. So these can be easily followed up with smallish telescopes to look for their behavior and if there's variability. So there are about 20, 28 supernovae per year. In 2016, I've counted 8 so far, but perhaps this list is not complete. So there seem to be enough that there are quite a few actually that one could follow up. So this is our plan to obtain light curves, high cadence photometry of other supernovae, not only type 1A, but type 2, any kind, right? We would like to see if we could find this evidence for rapid variability in other 1As, but also in the type 2s as well. The idea is to use, again, our facilities at the National Observatory of Athens, so the 2.3 meter. We have some scheduled nights, although it's more like a target of opportunity proposal, so we're not sure if there will be a bright supernova when we have our nights. We'll see how that goes. And we also have the 1.2 meter Crioneri telescope, where we're going to use the Nelliota Lunar Imager starting this fall. Now I'll tell you about it in the next slide, if you allow me to digress and tell you about the moon. So this is completely unrelated for a supernova conference, but it's a project that's upgrading our facility and will allow us to also observe supernovae. So Nelliota is actually an ESA project that started about a year ago at the National Observatory of Athens. The goal is to detect lunar flashes, lunar impact on the moon. The goal is, you have these near-Earth objects impacting the moon. There's no atmosphere, so they crash onto the surface, creating a flash that lasts for a second or even less. So you need a very fast-frame camera. We have RN I-band filters, 30 frame per second rate. Here is an artist's impression of what a lunar impact looks like. And actually, it's really cool that I'll mention this too, that the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter satellite is actually observing, taking images of the moon, and they find new craters, so you can trace it back to the impact. Okay, and then here's our logo and our observatory, actually, which I visited last week and took this picture last week. So just to conclude, we are very excited about this new method of high cadence photometry. I think it's quite a powerful tool to study not only type 1A, but core collapse supernovae as well. The idea is to study clumping, asphericity, shock breakout. There are many things that one can learn from that. And there are quite a few bright supernovae that we can follow up to measure this. We found evidence for rapid variability in supernova 2014J, as I mentioned in detail. We have a measurement of the decline rate of a supernova for 1A. And as I said, we'll be following up bright supernovae with the 1.2 meter and the 2.3 meter. So stay tuned. Thank you.
backs.
So I would encourage you to go after any bright nearby supernova impostors as well, because the interday variability there would be very telling about what's going on.
Sure, I think we're...
And probably much larger variation on a daily time scale.
Good point, yep.
Very, very nice work. Did you say that the supernova, when you were measuring the variations, that the radius was at 104 AU? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That kind of reminds me of the something like the cometary knots you see in the Helix Nebula, which some people have said is like way far away. I forgot how far away from the star it is. I mean, could it be running into just outer solar system material from the white dwarf system that got left? That's one possibility, it seems.
Yeah. So the projected area that's fluctuating, and you can imagine knots or something changing. Although I haven't done a calculation, obviously, to see what that would predict. It would be really cool if people doing simulations would predict such what the light curves would look like. Yeah.
So as your sample increases, I'm sure you've thought of this, it'll be interesting, perhaps very important, to see if there are certain supernova classifications that are more pronounced in their variability, and that'd be very interesting. The other thing is, you should think about coordinating high-cadence optical spectra simultaneous with your photometry, perhaps with a larger telescope. That would be a real way to kind of probe some of the possibilities behind the origin of this variability.
Well, that's a great idea. I think we'll encourage the community to do this too. There are many supernovae, so yes, we can talk. There's so much one person can do, or too few people.
I just want to say, in the world of classical novae, you have about 20% of your light curves have jitters at the very start during the plateau phase.
Oh.
And then they're followed by a deep dust dip.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be on carbon-oxygen white dwarfs rather than oxygen-neon-magnesium. And so I wonder if there's a connection somewhere.
Perhaps. I don't know yet, but I'll take a look at that. Yeah, thanks. So we're going down to 12th magnitude, though that's the requirement we have from ESA, and that corresponds to grams. It's a bit crazy. So there's work by the Marshall Suggs et al. At NASA Marshall Center, and they have a paper where they have, in order to find the mass, you have to make some assumptions, but anywhere from 30 grams, 100 grams, 10 grams. Yes, we'll be doing better than that, believe it or not. Yeah.
Okay.